full house today on this rainy old day. Some of the people who are with us are students that participate in a program that the court operates in coordination with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. This morning we have Palmyra Eagle High School. Would those students please stand? And their teacher? Very good. Thank you very much. You may be seated. We'd like to have you come and visit us. Hopefully you'll all generate a big interest in a career in the law, and we'll have that to come out of this. But if nothing else, you'll see a little bit about how your Supreme Court operates. When we are done with this argument, which is the only one that we have this morning, Justice David Prosser will come out and speak with the students, not about the substance of the case that we're hearing, but just a little bit more about how the court operates, how does it take cases, and whatever other pearls he tends to give during his discussion with the class. Now, I've introduced the students and by having them stand up, so we got to see who they are. So I'll introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice Michael Gableman. Next to him, Justice David Prosser. Next to me, Justice Abrahamson. I'm Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. And on the end, Justice Rebecca Bradley. With our introductions made, I'll now call the case for today, Coyne versus Walker, 13 AP 416. Now, we have a little bit of a breakdown on how we're going to do the argument this morning. Do we have a sheet on that, Tina, who gets what, so that we can agree? Oh, I got it. Thank you very much. Let me put my glasses on, and then I'll be able to read it, which is also helpful. To begin with, Attorney Meany will have 30 minutes. Then Attorney Essenberg will have 5 minutes, followed by 23 minutes for Susan Crawford, followed by 12 minutes for Ryan Nettleston, and 5 minutes for Michael Julka, and 5 minutes in rebuttal for David Meany. Does that meet with what you all think you're going to be doing today?
Yes, Your Honor.
Super. All right. Before you begin, you're fairly tall. You might want to raise the podium a little bit. There's a button on your left that allows you to do that.
Right.
Our speaker system in here is sometimes hard for us to hear, even though you're very close to us. So if you can do that, that would be great. It's magic, right? Very good. Thank you so much. Please.
May it please the court. Through any reasonable analysis, this case is a separation of powers case because it involves the relative powers of two branches of Wisconsin government, the legislature's power under Article 4 of our Constitution and the executive's power under Article 5. It also involves the power of the superintendent of public instruction, an executive officer within our divided executive branch, and the superintendent's power specifically under Article 10, Section 1 of the Constitution. I'd like to direct the court's attention in evaluating the separation of powers principles that are present in this case to the numerous concessions made by the respondents in this matter. Some of those concessions are echoed in the decision of the Court of Appeals. Specifically,
Can I just ask, you keep saying separation of powers. To me, this is more of a how is power dispersed within the executive branch case. And then when I look at the language of the Constitution, I'd like you, for me anyway, to address how the legislature can take from one executive officer and give to another executive officer certain power, and also address Article 5's language, which references the executive power being vested in the governor. And then Article 10 that talks about the supervision of public instruction being vested in the state superintendent and how that language of the Constitution has any effect on my issue, which is the dispersal of power within the executive branch.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I think that's a point that has been raised by the respondents in this case. And I think you have to look at what Act 21 relates to. Act 21 relates to a legislative power. That is conceded by all parties in this case. And it is the legislature's decision as to how to delegate that power to the executive, as occurs in administrative rulemaking. So at the core, what we're looking at is the power of the legislature, the administrative rule process, and the power of the executive branch, in this case initially under rulemaking, the power is delegated to the superintendent of public instruction, an executive branch officer. The fact the legislature, in exercising its power to control the administrative rule process, has also delegated power to another executive, the governor in this case, does not make this a dispute between the two executive officers. It is at its core the control of the legislative power by the legislature to control that administrative rule process. So I don't think it turns it into a dispute between two members of the executive branch.
Well, it sure does seem, doesn't it, that they're taking authority that the state superintendent would presumably have, and instead saying the governor can kind of trump that authority.
Well, the authority that is given to the superintendent to promulgate rules, as with other executive agencies, statutes provide that rules may be promulgated to fill in the statute. That's what Chapter 227.19 provides. That's the whole structure and scheme of administrative rulemaking. That power carries with it the ability to control the delegation, and the legislature can decide that when it delegates that authority, to split that authority with another executive officer, and it has done so in this case. It's part of a procedural safeguard that the legislature believed was necessary for the administrative rules process.
Do you place any emphasis on the language of the Constitution that says the executive power shall be vested in the government?
As a general statement of our separation of powers, we would have obviously no dispute with that. I don't believe that conflicts with the concept of administrative rulemaking being a delegated power of the legislative branch.
I just wondered if you thought the executive power meant of the executive officers. The governor has the has a supreme executive power, or
Yes, the governor does under the Constitution over the executive branch. What we have here, though, is a situation where, in particular with the superintendent, we have a divided office within the executive branch. It's a constitutional office, but the respondents don't contest that the superintendent is an executive officer within the executive branch.
Thank you. I'm sure my colleagues have questions.
Thank you. Counsel, if this court would view this case not as a separation of powers case, but rather a case with powers dispersed within the executive branch, do you lose?
I don't believe we lose, Your Honor, because, again, you must go back to the role and the undisputed power of the legislature to control administrative rulemaking. The legislature can decide.
Excuse me, but both of your arguments that you advance, as I understood it, your first argument that Act 21 is a limit on legislative rulemaking power, and your alternative argument, to the extent that the challenged provision of Act 21 affects power shared between the legislature and the superintendent. So I took both of your arguments in your brief, anyway, to depend on this legislative power versus the superintendent's power, which is concededly executive. Am I wrong on that?
I think in that general sense, you're correct, Your Honor, that this does relate to the legislative power to control rulemaking vis-a-vis the constitutional power of the superintendent, which is limited to the supervisory power, an executive, which can be characterized, we believe, as an executive supervisory power. And that power in Article 10, Section 1, does not control the legislature's ability to control the delegated rulemaking process.
But doesn't Act 21 interfere with the superintendent's ability to carry out his constitutional supervisory duties? Or could it possibly, if the governor decides to veto something that the superintendent of public instruction, under his watch, an administrative rule is proposed that would help the superintendent carry out an aim or a purpose that would be part and parcel of the supervisory function? Would it be? It wouldn't seem to me. It doesn't seem too difficult to envision a scenario where that could be blocked or checked by a governor who would not be friendly towards that.
Your Honor, I think there are several points to be made in response. One, the legislature has viewed this by the structure of Act 21 as an additional procedural safeguard on the administrative rulemaking process. To the extent that
I don't know how that runs to the idea, though, that if a governor had a mind to block something that the superintendent thought was necessary to carry out his, you know, we're talking about constitutional principles here, so we all want to tread very, very carefully. So if the superintendent says, I need this in order to carry out my constitutional duty, and then you have a governor, any governor, who says, no, I don't think that's right. I'm gonna block you from doing that. Isn't that interference with the constitutional officer's duties?
Well, there are mechanisms, and this is where we part ways with respondents. Again, the legislature has made the judgment that that is an appropriate safeguard. To the extent that, and this applies also only to new rules, to the promulgation of new rules, to the extent that the superintendent proposes a scope statement under Act 21 that is not approved by the governor, and the legislature decides that it disagrees with the governor, the governor's veto, if you will, is not absolute, and that's where we disagree with the respondents. The superintendent can also always go to the legislature and obtain, if the legislature does not agree with the governor, obtain
through legislation the same
administrative result through a statute. Now, of course, that statute would be subject to the governor's veto, but it would be subject to override by the legislature, and that really is a playing out of our normal give-and-take process where
that
we end
sort
up
of is the safeguard that your client seems to be relying on for why this would not be an impermissible intrusion upon the superintendent's constitutional duties for supervisory acts.
Yes, Your Honor, and we start out first, not to miss the point, that the promulgation in the first instance of legislative rules is not within the executive supervisory power under Article 10, the superintendent.
Sure, it would be the substance of whatever is proposed.
Well, why can't the superintendent, instead of labeling something a rule or a regulation, why don't you just label it an executive order by the superintendent? And do the same thing as a rule or regulation.
Well, I think that would raise a different issue as to whether the superintendent was acting within the powers and duties given by the legislature, Your Honor, which everyone recognizes is permissible under Article 10.
Well, no, it raises the question of whether whatever you call it is a rule, because rule is so broadly defined that it covers everything. I'm trying to find out what it doesn't cover. It covers policy. It covers internal operating procedures. It covers everything.
The legislature has determined directives or policies in a general sense that any executive agency, when the agency tries to implement them, whether or not that requires rulemaking. That is a staple of the analysis under administrative law. Does an action by the agency, can it be an informal policy, or does it require rulemaking? And obviously, if it requires rulemaking, Act 21 would then apply to the process.
What doesn't come under rulemaking? Now, I noticed that you have footnote 5 on page 8 of your reply brief, and you say, does the DOJ have any rules and regulations?
Yes, Your Honor. The Department of Justice does have administrative rules.
So because they're covered by this act, right?
Yes, Department of Justice is covered by
Act. So it operates in a crime alert network without any rules, it says. Well, it must have a definition of what the employees are supposed to do. It must have a statement somewhere about how this crime alert network works, who does what to whom, when, right?
There are certain, of course, internal operating procedures within the Department of Justice, as any other agency, to cover more mundane aspects of the government's operation.
Well, the definition of rule is very broad in the statute, right? Let's just read it together. It's 227, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, it goes on forever.
No,
it doesn't go on forever. It defines rules and then says there are a multitude of exceptions for the rules, but I didn't see the criminal alert system as an exception to the rules. Is there an exception to the rules?
Section 13 of 227.01 defines rules, but it has examples, parent A, parent through parent Z, D, parent. So it would take quite a long time to read them all today. So if you have a purpose and you need them read, I won't stand in the way. No, in fact, it goes further. It goes to parent Z, ZZ, parent.
So there are lots of examples. You don't have to worry about the examples because I don't see anything in there about the DOJ and its alert system. And it says rule means a regulation, standard, statement of policy, or general order of general application, which has the effect of law and was issued by an agency to implement, interpret, or make specific legislation enforced or administered by the agency, or to govern the organization or procedure of the agency. That's what it says. It then goes on to say, rule doesn't include the following. I'm not interested in that unless you can find an exception that covers the example you gave, which I couldn't find, but that doesn't mean it's not in there. So it seems to me almost everything. I'm trying to think of an example that isn't a regulation or rule under 13. And then there's another provision in here that is as broad.
Your Honor, if I may, the administrative agencies need to make decisions at all times as to whether certain operating procedures or interpretations of statutes require rulemaking. To the extent the public instruction has made that decision, I'm sure. Remember, Your Honor, that rulemaking is often directed by the legislature in the statute that establishes the program or the process. process at issue. So there is a directive that this, you know, any policy necessary to carry out this statute, the legislature has already made the determination that an administrative rule is appropriate.
So anything not covered in the statutes by a rule is not a rule? Is that what you're telling me?
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the agency will make the determination, just as the determination has been made up until this point, as to whether or not a certain policy or procedure that it wants to put in place requires rulemaking. If it does require rulemaking, then Act 21 applies.
That's how I started this questioning, saying, can't the superintendent decide that it's not a rule and promulgate it as a general executive order or something else?
Hypothetically, the superintendent could make a decision which was contrary to our body of administrative law as to what is a rule, and then the legislature obviously would have the opportunity to take action directing the superintendent that he or she could not do that.
I think if I understood your point earlier, tell me if I'm wrong, it can be boiled down to what the legislature gives and the legislature can take away, or at least modify.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that is the essence of the legislative rulemaking process. It is the essence of Article 10, Section 1, which says that the superintendent's duties are to be prescribed by law.
And one of the ways that the legislature chooses to do that is to permit each agency, to the extent the legislature chooses to delegate or to repose within the agency the authority to pass administrative regulations that have the force of law. To the extent it chooses to do that, it can choose to withdraw authority or to modify that authority. And I think I see, am I summing it up correctly?
Yes, or place conditions on that authority.
Right.
The
well,
condition here
that would be under modified. And so the tact you're taking would seem to be, it's not a clash of constitutional authority or duties that are prescribed to each of the executives, but rather it is an exercise of legitimate legislative ability to modify the grant of authority that it is given to particular agencies to create their own rules.
Yes, Your Honor, and it's a clash in the sense that in this case the superintendent has disagreed with the restriction.
I'm only talking about a clash in the Senate. I'm worried about the Constitution.
Yes.
Of course I care about the particular administrative agencies at play here and the executive. Of course I care. But my eye is on the Constitution. And you're saying this is not the constitutional crisis that someone painted as, because it has to do with the legislative, the authority that rests with the legislature to provide, modify, remove, restrict, whatever word you used, I can't remember, the rulemaking authority for the respective agencies.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what Act 21 does. That's what distinguishes this case from the Act 27 of 1995, which was the subject of the Thompson case, which went to the executive supervisory.
And balance. You're saying that as a safety valve, the safety valve there, is if this, in this instance, happens to be the superintendent of public instruction, if the superintendent sees a rule or a law, let's call it what it is, as being necessary to fulfill his functions under the Constitution, the safety valve is to go through the legislative process.
Correct, Your Honor. And that may not be necessary because the legislature may agree with the action of the governor, either at the scope statement stage of Act 21, Section 4 of the Act, or the approval of the final draft rule. And if I could return to the concessions in this case, because I do think they frame this court's approach to the issues that have been raised so far. The next concession made by respondents is that the power to engage in administrative rulemaking could be withdrawn from the superintendent at any time by the legislature. And that power, of course, springs from the legislative rulemaking process itself. And also, the Court of Appeals recognized that power. And again, it sets up a conflict with the overall position of the respondents in this case. In addition, at page 6 of their surreply brief, the plaintiff's respondents concede that they have not argued that the superintendent has the constitutional authority to make administrative rules. I think that's a key concession in this case.
You would say that's purely a legislative authority.
Correct.
Counsel,
in my mind, to your very recent comment of trying to distinguish the Thompson case from 1996 with the issue before us today and Act 21, but the Thompson case said at pages 698 and 699, indeed, that the constitutional difficulty with the education provisions of then Act 27 is not that it takes away power from the office of SPI, but rather it gives power of supervision of public instruction to another officer. And so it seems to me that for your position to prevail on the question of whether or not legislature can take away this power, they can't take away this power, necessarily implicates whether or not Thompson has to be overruled.
As our briefs show, Your Honor, we don't believe that it is necessary for this court to overrule the broad rationale of Thompson.
How about the specific rationale of Thompson?
Well, if the specific rationale is the one you cited, or generally speaking, that the legislature cannot give any supervisory power equal or greater to any other officer, if the court believes that Thompson cannot be properly limited to legislation that relates to the executive supervisory powers of the superintendent, which is not what Act 21 does. It relates to the administrative rulemaking powers of the legislature. But to the extent that this court believes that it cannot get around that broad rationale, we would ask the court to overturn that broad rationale and return to the original, the meaning, the plain meaning of Article 10, Section 1. And we would ask the court to follow the reasoning in Justice Wilcox's concurrence in Thompson. Justice Wilcox concurred only in the result under the facts of Act 27 back in 1995, which did things far different to the powers of the superintendent than Act 21 does, but we would follow that reasoning where Justice Wilcox rejected the unnecessary broad rationale of Thompson. That
so your alternative is your fallback argument includes if you can't see fit or appropriate to limit Thompson, indeed, it has to be overruled. Is that right? Because I was going to ask you, Mr. Essenberg is going to stand up in a few minutes, and if it's his argument is consistent with his brief, he's going to say, overrule Thompson. And my question was going to be, so what's wrong with his argument? So, but that's your alternative argument to overrule
That is
Thompson?
Correct, Your Honor. This court believes that Act 21 and its relationship to the duties of the superintendent under Article 10, Section 1 cannot be put together in harmony, then we do believe that that broad rationale of Thompson must be overturned. And for the reasons, again, in a nutshell, that Justice Wilcox laid out. Justice Wilcox focuses on the plain meaning of Article 10. He also takes issue with some of the presumptions that the Thompson Court made as to the legislative history of the adoption of the Constitution of Article 10 in 1848. He focuses instead on the 1902 amendment. That is the most recent visit that the legislature made, and indeed the people of the state, when they adopted it. And Justice Wilcox found nothing in either the plain meaning of Article 10 or the 1902 amendments or the debate which made the superintendent superior to all other officers in all respects and under any scenario.
Counsel, one of the statutes that's challenged is, or spoken about, is 227-137-6, which addresses proposed rules that would have an economic impact of $20 million or more. And then if it does, Department of Administration has to review the rule. What is before the enactment of that section? What happened with expenditures that were $20 million or more? How were they handled if they were the effect of a proposed rule?
I believe, Your Honor, there was the requirement of a statement as to the economic impact, but there was not the requirement that imposed requiring the Secretary of the Department of Administration to pass on the economic impact statement.
So, well, there must have been some supervision of the money that was spent. Regardless, I mean, they surely supervise our money from the court. So I can't imagine that the Secretary had the ability to have DPI pass any rule and put a economic impact statement on it that was $50 million, and that was the end of the story.
Well, Your Honor, under prior rulemaking procedures, for example, once the, and this is not part of the scope statement, this part of the proposed final rule,
yep,
it went from the agency to the legislature and did not have that intermediate requirement of approval by either the governor or the secretary of the Department of Administration. But it was accompanied, as I understand, by a report to allow the legislature to assess on its own what the economic impact would be of the proposed rule.
Okay, so what the legislature delegated then in 227-137-6 is delegated to DOA to make a review that it had made in the past of the economic impacts of proposed rules. Is that?
I believe that's the correct way to describe what has occurred here.
Doesn't the DOA have a veto power?
Excuse me just a minute. I just want to finish my questions. So if that is the case, the secretary, it would have been a shared power always between the legislature and the secretary's office on whether the rule could go forward given the economic impact that was going to be attached to it.
Well, certainly the legislature, in its consideration of a proposed rule, has its own inherent authority to reach out to any part of the executive branch to get input as to the economic impact of the rule, and I'm sure that took place. What Act 21 did was require the approval for certain types of rules having a certain level of impact of the secretary.
Okay, thank you.
Now, under 6, the secretary's approval is needed for it to go forward. That's different than than a fiscal impact statement.
That is correct. The secretary considers the economic impact statement of reaching that, and that has been an issue in this case, though the focus has obviously been on the governor's role in approving scope statements and proposed final rules.
So the agency may not submit a proposed rule to the legislature for review until the agency receives a copy of the department's report and approval of the Secretary of Administration. That's new.
Your Honor, Chief Justice, I noticed my red light is...
Yeah, please answer the question. Thank you.
Excuse me, Your Honor, can you repeat the question?
I said under subsection 6, the DOA has to approve this report before the agency's rulemaking would go ahead.
Yes, that is correct.
And that's new compared to the old statute.
Yes, that is new in Act 21.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Meany, there is a table of contents for the Wisconsin Administrative Code. Does Act 21 apply to all the rules in the Wisconsin Administrative Code?
Act 21 applies to new rules that are being promulgated, Your Honor.
New rules?
That are coming through. The provisions of Act 21 at issue here apply to new rules that are being promulgated by administrative agencies.
Okay. So the definition of agency is pretty broad, is it not? The definition of agency is pretty broad, is it not?
I believe that's correct in terms of what bodies need to comply with Chapter 227.
Would that apply to the Judicial Commission?
To the extent that it did not involve other distinct separation of powers issues, it would have to be examined as to whether those requirements in Act 21 did impinge on a constitutional function reserved to the judiciary.
Well, that really isn't the judiciary, the Judicial Commission. The Director of State Courts promulgates rules.
Yes, and we would take the position that Act 21 does apply to
the Director of State Courts and to the Public Service Commission?
Yes.
And the Government Accountability Board or anything that succeeds it?
Yes, sir.
Are there any limitations on this sort of approval power by the governor of any agency that's not covered?
Well, to the extent that if an agency is not covered by Chapter 227 rulemaking requirements, then Act 21 would not be implicated and the governor would not have a role, if I understand the question correctly.
Is it your position today that the Attorney General has no problem about a governor being able to say the Department of Justice cannot proceed with a rule?
As I mentioned before, Your Honor, the Department has taken the position that Act 21 applies to the Department. It should be noted that the Attorney General, under our Constitution, has only those powers and duties prescribed by law. There is no analogy to Article 10, Section 1. But the Department has taken that position. Again, with the safeguard that if the Department believes that the governor is not permitting something to go forward that is, in the view of the Attorney General, critical to the mission of the Attorney General, the Department would have the option of going directly to the legislature.
Thank you very much, Counsel.
I have one other question. If the department, any department, wants to amend an existing rule, that comes under these new rules, right? And is the Department of the Superintendent of Public Instruction sui generis in the Constitution? In other words, is there any other officer that has the same power and as here is vested in the superintendent with the statement that the legislature can appoint or nominate or name other officers? I could find nothing that was substantially similar.
Your Honor, I believe that's correct. The Secretary of State, the Treasurer, and the Attorney General do not have statute or constitutional provisions similar to Article 10.
But I noted that the legislative branch has legislative policy or legislative powers are vested in the legislature, the executive powers are vested in the governor, and the judicial powers are vested in the court system, with the legislature being able to set up trial courts, right?
Yes.
Legislature, yes. So I assume that the legislature might be limited in setting up trial courts and doing things by the fact that power is vested in the court system, in the judiciary.
I would not agree with that in a general sense.
Pardon me?
I would not agree that the legislature would be limited in establishing our court, the structure of our court system.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning. If respondents are correct, Thompson took language that says that the power of supervision shall be vested in the superintendent and such other officers as the legislature may direct, to mean that this power shall be vested in the superintendent and no other officers. If that's correct, as Justice Wilcox Steinmetz feared, the impact of Thompson's broad language has become unjust and unworkable. Not only, according to respondents, must the superintendent retain some core authority, or even more authority than everyone else, no one may be tasked, vested, with a power that is free, that is not subject to the superintendent's control. The superintendent may not be made, as here, to seek the concurrence of anyone else in anything. The legislature must commit each and everything it does in public education to the control of the superintendent or not act at all. Thompson's broad language transforms a shared power to be allocated by the legislature into the sole and absolute power of the superintendent. Even the government.
Professor, what you are saying seems to be entirely consistent with one of the two letters from the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Lorenzo Dow Harvey. The majority in Thompson relied on one letter. Justice Wilcox, in his concurrence, points out another letter in regard to the 1902 amendment where Harvey wrote, "The only purpose in the amendment beyond that of making it possible to put the election of county superintendents in the spring was to make the provision broad enough to meet any demand of the people at any time in the future in the organization of the school system." And it seems in our representative democracy, the people act through their legislature, as your co-counsel has already argued. The emphasis here is on the power of the legislature to either grant, modify, or eliminate the rulemaking authority. So is there anything inconsistent in your argument with what Superintendent Harvey expressed as the purpose of the 1902 amendment?
No, I don't think so. If you look at the extrinsic sources, well, if you look at the plain meaning of the text, I think that it's quite clear that the power is shared as determined by the legislature. If you look then to the extrinsic sources, one might conclude that the superintendent has more than exoratory authority. The Thompson Court did that. One might conclude then that the superintendent cannot be completely stripped of his or her authority, and that perhaps then Thompson was correct in its result, if not in its broad language. Because if you read that broad language the way that the respondents urge you to, then not one jot or tittle of the superintendent's authority may ever be given to someone else. And that, I would submit, is impossible to recognize, to reconcile with the clear constitutional text, and is not compelled with any compelled by
I'm
any of
sure
the extrinsic sources.
I'm not sure that's right. Thompson talks about the supervisory authority that is granted under the Constitution to the SBI. And I say, I'm not sure that's correct. I'm not sure it's wrong either. But if we focus on what is that, what does the supervisory and supervisory authority mean, and how, if at all, can it serve as sort of a shield against the legislature exercising its authority to grant, modify, restrict, or eliminate the delegation of rulemaking authority to the agencies. That's not entirely clear, but I think we're following.
And here I think this is at least analogous to a more traditional separation of power case in which we sort of find ourselves within the borderlands of power. And one of the things it seems to me that the court could do in this case is it could say, look, rulemaking is a delegated legislative authority, and just as the governor checks the exercise of direct legislative authority, he may also check the exercise of delegated authority. But my light is on, and although I have more to say, I have no time to say.
How would you deal with the technical college system and the university system?
How would I deal with the technical college or the university system? Well, I think that those agencies would be subject to Act 21. It seems to me that it is the case that the superintendent has to retain some authority. That is, the legislature could not relegate the superintendent to a desk, you know, outside in the rotunda where, you know, he could hold up signs and say, you know, public schools are a great thing. But to say that because the superintendent cannot be simply completely stripped of his or her authority, to say that that means that the superintendent may not be compelled by the legislature in light of the exigencies of the times to share authority with another officer is an entirely different question. And it seems to me that the plain meaning of the text speaks to that, and none of the extrinsic sources undercut that plain meaning.
Thank you very much.
What I'm really trying to get at is that and that a public instruction plays a role in the university system. And I believe the superintendent plays a role in the technical college system. But I don't think he's the boss of either one of them. And so that power has been, if he ever had it, has been taken away.
That's right. Nor is the superintendent the boss of over 400 school districts throughout the state of Wisconsin. The superintendent cannot fire the superintendents of those school districts and cannot engage in their daily management. To say that the superintendent, even to say that the superintendent must be the primary officer of public instruction in this state, does not mean that the superintendent must be the boss in each and every way, and that everything that the legislature might want to have done in this very, very important and very, very huge area of public policy has to somehow be submitted to the control of the state superintendent of public instruction, or the legislature may not act at all.
Thank you. As I read your brief, you think Thompson has to be overruled. Thompson v. Craney has to be overruled. It cannot just be distinguished.
You know, Justice Abrahamson, we get into this sort of metaphysical question of to what extent is the rationale of the decision part of the holding, and we know that to some extent it is. My position and the position of the parties I represent is that we're not asking the court to declare that the result in Thompson was wrong, but that this broad language, at least as it's interpreted by the respondents here, goes too far. Now, whether this court, and you're sitting up there, I'm sitting down here, so it's your determination, if this court believes that that can be done by clarifying the language of Thompson, I will be a very, very happy lawyer. Whether or not you have to overrule it or clarify it, it seems to me that the key thing is to make clear what the proper scope of of Article 10, Section 1 is.
And what do you suggest that we would say?
I would say that Article 10, Section 1 provides that the legislature may allocate authority between the state superintendent and whatever other officers the legislature may so prescribe. This does not mean that the superintendent must be superior with respect to each allocated power, or that an other officer may not be tasked to check the exercise of authority of the superintendent, at least insofar as the superintendent retains an important public role with respect to the supervision of public instruction.
You know, the Chief Justice and the members of this bench know that I very seldom ask a question after the red light is on. I'm going to make this observation. I've been hearing a lot of discussion from all attorneys, from members of the bench, talking about who's the boss, whose power is subordinate, whose power is superior. For whatever it's worth, I invite counsel and all others interested to note that in our representative democracy, it is the will of the people, as expressed through the legislature, which enjoys primacy, unless those actions are demonstrated beyond a reasonable doubt to be unconstitutional. So I just need to add that. I've been hearing too much about who the boss is. Well, let's turn our attention to who the real boss is. Thank you. That's enough.
Counsel, do you have an answer to that question? Because I have a follow-up. Do you need to answer that?
Well, I agree that ultimately, unless there's some constitutional restriction, that, you know, the legislature can do what it wants.
It was beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's absolutely correct.
You finished with the answer to the question?
Am.
Okay. I've read Thompson, and I've read the briefs, and your last sentence in your brief says overrule Thompson. I find it hard to understand the argument now of Thompson maybe doesn't need overruling. For instance, earlier in the questions, you responded to a letter from Harvey in 1902. Thompson, case Thompson, addressed those letters, page 692 and 693. And came to the conclusion of directly opposite of what you are arguing as to what those letters meant. So at least that part of Thompson has to be overruled, doesn't it?
Thompson's broad language, at least as it's read by the respondents, would have to be overruled, because to the extent that you read Thompson to say that not a single power can be given to anyone else, or that not a single power can be given to the superintendent that is then checked by anyone else, then it seems to me that Thompson is wrong. Of course, that wasn't the case in Thompson. The superintendent had been largely rendered superfluous. And, you know, I know from a long career practicing law that oftentimes a court will go back and it will look at language that it adopted addressing the issue before it and say, look, you know, to the extent that this language can be read to mean such and such, that understanding is disavowed. What we said at the beginning of our brief is that we thought that the important thing was that the correct interpretation of Article 10, Section 1 be made clear, because right now the broad language of Thompson, particularly given the way that it has been interpreted by the public instruction, Department of Public Instruction, has impeded the development of innovative solutions in the area of educational reform. And so if Thompson has to be overruled to do that, so be it. If this court, after considering Thompson, believes that it may say that we simply are clarifying the rationale in Thompson, that we are saying that, no, we did not go as far in 1996 as the Department of Public Instruction, and the plaintiffs in this case believe that we went, I think that that's fine. To some extent, it becomes a sort of a metaphysical question as to whether you're doing the one or you're doing the other, and I find it sort of easier to talk about the outcome than the characterization of it.
You know, Professor, you were put at a disadvantage because you were asked a misleading question by Justice Bradley. As the concurrence points out, the majority did not cite at all the letter that I quoted from and which you endorsed. It was cited only in Justice Wilcox's concurrence. And so, therefore, I think you are entitled to know you have not contradicted yourself as far as I know.
I try not to contradict myself. I hope I'm successful most of the time.
Good. Thank you very much, Counsel.
Just one follow-up question. You start your brief citing Justice Wilcox's concurrence and then end your brief saying espousing the concurrence is correct and end the brief saying that Thompson should be overruled. One of the things that I smiled in reading your brief was citing for the premise of Johnson controls, citing Johnson controls for the premise of the importance of stare decisis. Stare decisis, of course, means, I'll use vernacular, we're wedded to precedent. Precedent should stand. And I recalled, because I joined in Justice Wilcox's dissent in Johnson controls, where he said, the only thing that has changed is the personnel of this court and this court's view as to the proper definition of damages and suit. And then he goes on to quote some other authorities about, you know, this is a court of law and not of personality. What has changed in the 20 years that should cause us to overrule a unanimous decision?
What has changed is that that this case is here today, that that a decision which said that you can't make the state superintendent superfluous has now been turned into a rationale for saying that the state superintendent has a vested executive authority that may not be shared with anyone else, that is in fact more absolute than that allocated to the governor, because we know that the legislature often allocates administrative responsibilities to someone else. What's happened is that we've seen, as Justice Wilcox and Steinmetz feared, that this broad language would take us to a place which is well beyond that which was before the court in Thompson. And although stare decisis is very, very important, this is not a case where private parties simply have to allocate themselves to a rule that may be wrong. This is a case which goes to the understanding of our Constitution, and as Justice Gableman points out, the prerogative of the people's elected representatives. And in that case, I think there is a particular obligation.
So what's changed
to get it right? What's gotten it?
Yes. Can you answer that just real?
Again, sure. What's happened is that the implications that Justice Wilcox and Steinmetz feared, which the majority was not concerned about, have actually come to pass.
Okay.
That this rationale is being used in a way which is far more capacious and goes well beyond what was before the court in 1996.
You mentioned Justice Wilcox's concurrence, and let the record reflect that the Harvey letters are part of the majority on pages 692 and 693, the concurrence beginning on page 700.
Thank you very much, Justice Bradley, and thank you, Counsel. We'll now move on to the respondents. I want you all to know that I didn't chide my colleagues today about adhering to the red lights. Counsel is always very good about looking at the red lights. The court is often bad, and in the past, since I began as Chief Justice, I tried to remind my colleagues to please mind the red lights so we are fair to both sides. At this point, according to my watch, and I don't have a stopwatch, the petitioners have gotten 20 minutes because of the court's questions after the red light went on. So I will allocate more time to the respondents so that you are treated fairly, Tina. And I don't know how you can do that with the lights, but it is the court's problem the court has created, and I do not want to treat one side unfairly. So I want to be sure you have a similar opportunity to give your case and to answer questions from the bench. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Susan Crawford. I'm here representing the plaintiff's respondents, Peggy Coyne et al. They're a group of taxpayers, parents, school children, and public school teachers. What we're asking the Court to hold today is that specific provisions of Act 21 put the governor in control of the rulemaking of the superintendent of public instruction and thereby violate Article 10, Section 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution. The central issue...
Make sure you speak up, Counsel. The acoustics here are challenging.
Try to move a little closer to the mic.
Thank you.
The central issue in this case was decided by this court just about 20 years ago in Thompson versus Craney, which held that Article 10, Section 1 vests the supervision of public instruction in the superintendent of public instruction, and that while the legislature may prescribe the superintendent's powers and duties, it cannot make the superintendent subordinate to another officer in carrying out those duties. And that's exactly what Act 21 does. It makes the superintendent subordinate to the governor and the secretary of administration when making rules for public instruction. It requires the superintendent to get the governor's approval before even drafting a rule and also before submitting a proposed rule to the legislature for its review. It treats the superintendent, Act 21, treats the superintendent exactly the same as a cabinet secretary who's appointed by the governor and serves at the pleasure of the governor.
How can that be, as your opposing counsel points out, how can what you say be factually true if the superintendent has the mechanism to go directly to the legislature to seek that which the governor would attempt to veto? And no cabinet secretary would have that authority. And if they tried to exercise it, they probably wouldn't be a cabinet secretary. Mm-hmm. Right?
Certainly that's true. The fact that the legislature, in exercising legislative authority,
yes,
can go forward and put into place through legislation, proposed rules that the superintendent would have liked to have proposed, does not mean that, in this case, the governor is not interfering with the executive authority as prescribed by law to the superintendent.
So we've gone from preventing to interfering. We're now, it's not the governor preventing, it's the governor interfering.
Well, it's both, in my opinion. It's interfering and preventing the superintendent from carrying out duties and responsibilities assigned by the legislature.
Again, we're missing somebody. We're missing the legislature. You heard your opposing counsel indicate that what the legislature gives vis-a-vis the rulemaking authority to the various agencies, the legislature can take away. Do you agree with that or disagree?
I agree that the legislature can delegate rulemaking authority to agencies, including the superintendent, and can take away that delegated authority in individual circumstances. And modify, correct.
All right. So how does that square with the argument? I mean, it's not a fight. It's being presented to us and to the public a little bit, I think, as a call for a determination of primacy between the governor and the superintendent. And in my estimation, and I'm open to hearing other views, in my estimation, that's leaving a very important player not receiving the same level of attention that it ought to have here, which is the legislature. If we're talking about a legislative part, you know, the three branches, here we are, and then we have the legislative branch, and we have the executive, both the governor and the superintendent. So really, we're not talking exclusively about an interplay between two executive officers. We're talking about the interplay of the legislature and the legislative powers, to delegate basically legislative authority. We call it rulemaking authority, but it has the force of law. People can go to jail for violating administrative codes. It has the force of law. They can lose their homes. they can be fined $1,000 a day. So how is it? This is what I'm interested in. Of course, as I said, I'm interested in the particular players in this litigation, but I want to know how this plays out in the future. And I guess it boils down to a pretty simple concept of why is it what the legislature has done here in its exercise of its lawful authority, as you and I just agreed a minute ago, to modify the rulemaking authority that it has granted to the department. Why has what the legislature done, why is that impermissible?
I think it's important to look at administrative rulemaking and what function rulemaking serves in modern day government. This court has described rulemaking as the way that the executive branch gives effect to legislative policies. It's the way that the agencies, in this case the superintendent, administer the public education system in accordance with the policies.
Those are statements of goals, not always of fact.
Please,
please
continue.
Yes, please continue.
The Article 10, Section 1 of the Constitution uses the words vesting authority to supervise public instruction. It also provides that the legislature may assign powers and duties to the superintendent in order to carry out that supervisory role. In many instances, the legislature has assigned duties and responsibilities to the superintendent to make rules so that legislative policy, written large, can be put into effect across the 2,200 public schools serving over 900,000 students in our public education system. What Article 10, Section 1, the principle that Article 10, Section 1 stands for, as articulated by this court in Thompson, is that the legislature can assign duties and responsibilities to the superintendent. It can modify those duties. It can take away those duties, but it cannot place another officer in a position superior to the superintendent in carrying out those duties. And that's what the problem is.
But the 1902 amendment says the supervision of public instruction shall be vested in a state superintendent, so far so good, and such other officers as the legislature shall direct. So
And the court in Thompson gave a very careful look at that language and engaged in an extremely thorough analysis of that language, looking at both the meaning of the words themselves, the historical setting in which they were adopted by the framers,
the letters
and the first,
you're talking about.
Among other things,
right.
Yes, Your Honor,
yeah.
And the first laws that were enacted after the Constitution was adopted. And it determined, first of all, that there was ambiguity as to whether those other officers were intended by the framers of the Constitution to be subordinate officers, to be local officers that were supervising the district schools, or whether they were intended to be other officers that are on par or equal to the superintendent. The court, after looking at that historical record, including the letters of Superintendent Harvey, concluded that those other officers referenced in Article 10, Section 1, were local officers who were intended to be subordinate to the the superintendent of public instruction. The amicus and the state present no reason for this court to overturn its careful reading and its interpretation of that language in the Wisconsin Constitution. That language has stood for over 20 years as the leading authority interpreting that constitutional provision, and up until very recently with the enactment of Act 21, there's been no reason to.
Sure, and that starts out where you began, or that kind of winds up where you began with it, which is Thompson. We've had Thompson for 20 years. And what's wrong with it? With careful study, But that raises an issue which is not as seldom necessary to address as we would like, which is what do we do with case law? And now Chief Justice Roberts gave a very eloquent response during his confirmation hearings, where he gave a three-factor test, which is if a new judge or a new justice comes on board and decides that, gee, that 20-year-old case, I'm not sure the court got it right in that matter. Now, that doesn't, in Chief Justice Roberts' view and in mine, that doesn't automatically lead to a reason to say, gee, just because the legal reasoning behind it was not as was a little more infirm than I would have liked to have seen, that doesn't automatically lead a judge or justice to vote to overrule it. But I invite your comment, the same as I did with one of your opposing counsel. Justice Wilcox, at page 702, in his concurrence, he repeated a letter that had been cited by the majority. And then he said a similar sentiment as represented in another of letter in another letter of Harvey's, not cited by the majority, in which he stated, now here's the sentence that's the relevant part, the only purpose in the amendment beyond that of making it possible to put the election of county superintendents in the spring was to make the provision broad enough to meet any demand of the people at any time in the future in the organization of the school system. So that seems a little different from the language that had been focused on.
Well, with all due respect to Justice Wilcox, I think that he was taking portions of that letter out of context and also reading in an inference that is not present in Superintendent Harvey's correspondence.
Spell that out, please.
Well, if you look at the letters of Superintendent Harvey, and I have, I've reviewed all of that correspondence, his concern was that the local officials then in charge of the schools at that local level were elected in partisan elections, and that people who were running for those offices were not necessarily people who were experts in public education or were looking at that as their career and their life's work, but rather were using that office, then a partisan elective office, as a stepping stone to higher office. And Superintendent Harvey was concerned with having those local officials be individuals who were properly focused on public education and wanted to ensure that the Constitution allowed the legislature at some point to change the way that those local officials are elected, appointed, how their qualifications are determined. He does not at any point in that correspondence suggest that those local officials should be on par with the same powers and responsibilities as the superintendent of public instruction.
Anybody's contending that.
The position was that the local officials are...
Justice Prosser has
may I ask you a hypothetical question? Suppose Act 21 applied only to the Department of Corrections. Would there be any problem with it?
I don't think that there would be, Your Honor. The requiring the Department of Corrections to run its rules or proposed rules by the governor when that is a cabinet agency whose secretary is appointed by and serving at the pleasure of the governor seems consistent with the governor's executive authority over that area.
Okay. What about the Department of Employee Trust Fund?
Well, the plaintiffs have not challenged the provisions of Act 21 as it applies to any of the independent state agencies, of which the Department of Employee Trust Funds is one. I have not spent a lot of time analyzing or developing any arguments as to whether there may be other constitutional infirmities in Act 21 as it applies to agencies that are not, you know, within the governor's control. I think, honestly, there may be an issue there, in part because Act 21 delegates such broad and untrammeled authority to the governor to shut down any kind of administrative rulemaking without any limitations on his discretion, without any standards, without any ability to have public input. There's no requirement of a public hearing or publication or anything of that sort for the governor to step in and say, it's not happening. So I do think that there are potentially some broader issues here, but again, our focus in this case is on the superintendent's authority.
Here's my problem on Thompson v. Crane. See if you can resolve this. Opposing counsel say that Thompson v. Crane really means you can't marginalize the powers of the Department of Public Instruction or the superintendent. You can't marginalize them. And there, the statute took away almost all the powers and left him with the title and sitting on the board or boards. Well, I keep rereading Thompson v. Crane, and Thompson v. Crane says, under our holding in the present case, the legislature may not give equal or superior authority to any other officer. This case does not require us to decide the extent to which the SBI's powers may be reduced by the legislature, and we reserve judgment on that issue. So they don't say, hey, you can take away all the rulemaking power from the legislature. Thompson v. Crane doesn't say that. Take away all the rulemaking power of the superintendent. In several places, Thompson v. Crane says that what you can't do is disperse the power of the superintendent. And they reserve judgment on everything else. Why am I not reading this correctly, and why aren't you emphasizing that?
Well, I think, Your Honor, you are reading it correctly. And I think that what the court was commenting on there is that in a particular instance, let's say the legislature decided that it no longer wanted the superintendent to promulgate rules for teacher certification, but rather that the legislature wanted to enact legislation that had a sufficiently detailed and comprehensive scheme for certification of teachers that no rulemaking was necessary. The legislature, in my opinion, could take that set of rulemaking away from the superintendent and enact positive legislation that accomplished that goal. So I think what Thompson was saying is that in a particular area, as to particular duties and responsibilities that the legislature has prescribed by law to the superintendent, the legislature can take those things away or modify them or, you know, add new duties and responsibilities. But what it can't do is, vis-a-vis another officer, shift control and power to another officer that's superior to the superintendent. And I think that, you know, it is consistent within the four corners of the Thompson opinion. The court perhaps could have spelled out its reasoning a little more comprehensively in that part of the decision you're citing, but I think that it is consistent with the overall holding.
It seems to me you just used the phrases power and control as being synonyms. And as Justice Abrahamson, the section that she was just reading from, beginning at paragraph 19 of the Thompson, we note, however, that the constitutional difficulty with the education provisions of Act 27 is not that it takes power away from the office of SPI, but rather that it gives the power of, so in other words, it's giving control. And as Justice Abrahamson just pointed out, the court there reserved for another day the question of how much power, not control, that's established. And it's, but we deal, we are now wrestling with the question that the top, it seems to me, we're now asked to address, and we have to wrestle with the question that the Thompson court put off to a different day. How much power can be taken away from the superintendent? So I think we go down a confusing, an unnecessarily confusing road that distracts from the issue if we say power and control are the same things. They're most definitely not, especially within this context. So narrowing in, I'm glad you said it because it brought to sharper focus in my mind the questions that we're going to have to address, and I invite your comment on how should we answer that question. You've been talking now, as you started out by saying, well, Thompson answers the question, and Thompson's been around for 20 years, and Thompson's good law, so no reason to change it. But now it seems to me that there's actually a lot sharper question that Thompson did not address and we have to address now. How would you like us to answer that question? How much power can the legislature redirect from SBI to a different agency? And how is the rulemaking authority of the legislature implicated by your answer?
Well, just to take a step back to the beginning of your comments, Your Honor, I think that power and control are very interrelated concepts because
of course they're interrelated, but they're not synonymous.
Because you have to have power to be able to exercise control. And the issue here is that the legislature has delegated rulemaking duties and responsibilities to the superintendent, but it has given to the governor the powers to control that exercise of rulemaking by the superintendent.
Okay, but that wasn't the question in Thompson, with all due respect, to use your phrase. That wasn't the question in Thompson. The question in Thompson was an act that gave the power of supervision to somebody other than the superintendent. That's the question addressed there. Look, I don't want... This is not hostile questioning. I'm trying to explore with you the important question that is coming into focus as we're discussing, and I'm trying to give you an opportunity. And if you can't think of one, that's fine.
Your Honor, I'm doing my best to try to answer your questions. I'm still unsure of what the distinction is.
Okay, sure. The issue, and I'll try it once again, and then if we're just two ships passing in the night, then that'll be for us to talk about in the conference room. The issue in Thompson, it seems to me, was a wholesale transfer. A wholesale transfer of all of the supervisory control to someone other than the constitutional repository. There he is, the temporary one, Mr. Evers, sitting behind you in the front row. So that, unconstitutional. Question left for a different day under Thompson is, and this was Justice Abrahamson's question a few minutes ago, how much power, it didn't slam the door on the legislature, nor do I think it could have, but it didn't slam the door on the legislature from exercising any power as opposed to a transfer of control. So the question we're going to be having to wrestle with is how much power and the legislature, by means of its proper exercise of the rulemaking authority, delegate or modify its rulemaking so as to permit another constitutional officer to share the power, not to take control of the supervisory obligations.
Your Honor, I think the fundamental concern I have about the way you frame the issue is that you're characterizing the regime that's set up under Act 21 as a sharing of power between the, or I'm not sure if you use the word control or power here, but sharing between the governor and the superintendent. When, in fact, what the legislation does, it says that the superintendent must get the approval of the governor in order to even draft a rule. And that places the governor in a superior position to
I can see your point. I see your point. It's a good one. I didn't state it with as precision, with as much precision as I should have. What I was getting at was the sharing from my eye and from what my job is going to be once we start fashioning a rule for this case is not between the two people you are immediately concerned about, the governor and the superintendent, which is, again, I share your concern in general for all parties who appear in this case. The sharing, in my eye, is being divvied up, for lack of a more nicer sounding word. It's being allocated by the legislature. And allocation of power was not foreclosed by Thompson. And so it seems to me the legislature, taking a look at Thompson, says, well, we can't transfer all supervisory control to someone not the superintendent. We all agree with that, right? You agree with me? Yes? I'm looking for one note of accord here. Throw me a bone. But the question then left is, what can the legislature do? Because we have to be mindful of the legislative authority as well as the powers between the two. That's what I'm talking about when I'm using the word sharing.
Let me try to answer that, Your Honor.
It's actually an allocation instead of sharing.
Allocation of power to the governor.
From the legislature.
From the legislature.
By means of the rulemaking authority to allocate the power between the SPI and the governor.
I believe that it is drawing a distinction without a difference to describe the role that is assigned to the governor by Act 21 as an allocation of power rather than putting the governor in control of rulemaking by the superintendent. Because what the legislature has done is to prescribe rulemaking authority to the superintendent, but has required the superintendent to go to the governor to get the governor's permission to carry out that legislatively assigned duty.
To carry out one facet of the superintendent's authority.
And rulemaking, what does the superintendent do to carry out the supervision of public instruction? And are any of those things shared?
Well,
that might be a different way of asking a similar question.
No, I think that's helpful.
No, I think it's helpful, too. And, it, you know, earlier in the argument when Mr. Mina was presenting his case, the court engaged in a colloquy about the definition of rulemaking that's in the statutes. Rulemaking is a very broad concept, and whenever a state agency, or in this case the superintendent, wants to set a standard, have a generally applicable order, establish procedures for the agency to carry out its administrative functions, or to have a statement of policy, or to interpret a statute in a way that's going to have general applicability, a rule must be promulgated. That doesn't leave a lot of room for the superintendent to take actions to administer the public education system outside of rulemaking. certainly, you know, Thompson discusses the kind of hortatory role that the superintendent can play in, you know, encouraging public education and visiting schools and lobbying and advocating for public instruction. And that role does not require rules. But, you know, as Thompson made it very clear, the framers envisioned a much broader role for the superintendent than that.
Reconcile your argument with the pronouncement in the Fortney case that Article 10, Section 1 confers no more authority upon those officers, including the school superintendent, than must be delineated by statute.
Is your question about that discussion in Fortney versus the discussion of the superintendent's role in Thompson, how those are reconciled? Well, I think that, you know, the Fortney court was looking at a much narrower question. That case involved an issue about whether, I believe it was whether local officials can be bound by provisions in Chapter 111 that had to do with collective bargaining, and whether the local officials were bound by the agreements that they entered under collective bargaining. That case did not deal with a dispute involving the superintendent's authority vis-a-vis some other state official or local official even. It had to do with whether the legislature can enact laws that prescribe duties and responsibilities to those local officials. I think that's consistent with Thompson. And what Thompson addresses this, and I think that this is going back to the language that Justice Gableman was talking about, that there is a portion of Thompson right at the end of the decision that raises the question of to what extent can the legislature take away duties and responsibilities from the superintendent, or to what extent is there some vested authority under the Constitution that trumps the legislature's ability to do that? And I see my red light is on, Your Honor.
You may finish the answer.
All right, thank you. So I don't think that those two cases are in tension. The issue that was being addressed in Thompson, you know, was certainly a broader issue and a different issue because it was examining the superintendent's authority vis-a-vis other officers, and it wasn't this kind of narrow and focused discussion of whether the legislature can prescribe duties for local officials.
Wouldn't your interpretation of the vesting clause of Article 10, Section 1, in effect, though, swallow the legislature's power to prescribe the duties and powers of the superintendent?
No, Your Honor, because the legislature is no different really with the superintendent than it is with the governor. The governor cannot exercise executive power unless there is a law that has been duly enacted by the legislature. That's what executives do. They carry out, they give effect to laws enacted by the legislature. The superintendent, likewise, is carrying out and giving effect to laws enacted by the legislature. The legislature determines what his duties and responsibilities are by, you know, for example, giving him the responsibility to carry out teacher certification, graduation standards, standards for assistance of disabled students, et cetera, et cetera. It has very broadly defined the superintendent's responsibilities to administer an education system that is consistent with the policy direction as established by the legislature.
Is an Act 21 really a modification of the powers and duties of the superintendent?
I believe that it is not a modification of those duties. It does not take away his authority to promulgate rules in any specific area. It simply says that his responsibilities in those areas are subordinate to the governor. He must go to the governor to get approval before carrying out any of those statutorily prescribed duties.
But if the governor doesn't approve of the rule that the superintendent wishes to promulgate, the superintendent can go back to the legislature and have, therefore, another avenue for implementing the rule.
Sure, he can lobby. He cannot introduce a bill. The legislature can fix it by executing legislative powers. The superintendent cannot. He has no ability to enact legislation. He can ask. They can turn him down.
I want to explore the same kind of thing that some other people are exploring. Would you agree that the authority to license teachers could be changed to, could be transferred, say, to the Department of Safety and Professional Responsibility by legislation?
I believe that would present similar constitutional issues to those in this case, because it would take a central part of the supervision of public instruction out of the sphere of the superintendent and place it in a cabinet agency where the governor has control over it. So I do think that would raise some questions. Now, I can also think of a framework where that would not be the case. For example, suppose that legislation was enacted that gave the Department of
Safety and professional
responsibility. I'm sorry, yeah. Would allow that agency to propose rules, to draft rules, but then gave the superintendent the authority, as is kind of the flip side of Act 21 here, gave the superintendent the authority to approve or disapprove those rules and decide whether they're submitted to the legislature for approval. I think that would be constitutionally okay and consistent with Act 10, Section 1.
I have a question. I'm sorry.
If I might. Your answer is giving me. I didn't appreciate that was the answer that you were going to give me. I think you are now arguing that there are some absolutely core functions to the superintendent of public instruction that could not be taken away from the superintendent, even by clear legislation approved by the governor. And I thought your argument was a little bit different, that the legislature might transfer a duty away from the superintendent, but so long as the legislature does not clearly transfer that duty, the superintendent has the duty, and he can't have another executive officer simply impeding and frustrating the implementation of that duty or the exercise of that duty. Tell me why I'm wrong.
I don't think you're wrong, Your Honor. The hypothetical that you propose asked what I thought would happen if the legislature assigned rulemaking over teacher certification to another state agency. And under your hypothetical, really would entirely cut the superintendent out of that process. I think that's what you're implying. I believe that the certification of teachers is very well within the sphere of the supervision of public instruction that is constitutionally vested in the superintendent, and that the legislature could not carve that out of the superintendent's authority and give it to another executive branch agency. I think that become, you know, there probably are some gray areas, some fuzzy areas where it's not really clear whether a particular function is squarely within the supervision of public instruction or not. But when you look at teacher certification in particular, the very first laws that were enacted by the legislature after the Constitution was adopted gave the superintendent the responsibility to determine the standards for teacher certification, and I do think that falls within his sphere and could not be taken from his control and handed to another part of the executive branch.
Now, Now, I understand you weren't around in 1848.
But were you?
Changed the fact, yes.
Closer.
The functions that were assigned to the superintendent in 1848, were any of those functions exercised according to rules? Not maybe kind of normal administrative rules, but I mean, did they have any guideline, checklist, something?
In some of those first laws that were enacted both after the 1848 Constitution and that also after the 1902 amendments, and the court in Thompson looks at both, there was legislation requiring the superintendent to create rules. Something called the school laws the superintendent was required to develop. I have been unable to determine what was meant by the school laws. I am speculating that those would be a set of regulations that schools would follow in carrying out their functions. There were also requirements in that very early legislation that the superintendent develop rules for carrying out their processes and procedures as defined by the legislature, and again, that's quite similar to today, which under current law, those would have to go through a rulemaking process. And rulemaking, administrative rulemaking in 1848, granted, was not the same as it is now. It wasn't as developed. It wasn't as, the procedures were not as rigorous as they now are, but certainly in those very early laws, it was anticipated that the superintendent would set rules that the schools would follow. Thank you.
I have a comment. And see if I understand your argument. It was my understanding from your brief that you view Thompson v. Craney as a dispersal of power. That is, that the legislature could not give superintendent powers to other officers to the extent that they became superior. That may not be the right word, superior to the superintendent. It was a dispersal of power case. Yes. Is that right?
I think so, yes. Now, I hesitate a little bit because the word dispersal to me suggests something a little more amorphous, but what I believe Thompson is saying is that the superintendent, because he has vested constitutional authority to supervise public instruction, is the executive powers in carrying that out are assigned to him, not to the governor.
Okay. All right. That's well stated. That's what I intend, and that's how I read your brief. You then, Justice Prosser asked you a question about his made-up Department of Licensing, right? It is the Department of Licensing, okay.
There is a Department of Licensing.
It has a nice name to it now. Changed since last I looked.
Right, yes. I still think of it as regulation and licensing.
And seems to me that your response to him caught him by surprise, and it did me too. But when you then explained it further, that too was a distribution of a power in the superintendent had, and now a new person has it. And so the question is, you have to do a comparison between the two.
Right? I think that's right. Right.
So that, to me, fit in with what your argument in the brief was.
Okay.
And I think you've tried very hard not to get into the question of Thompson v. Craney reserved for another day.
I don't think that the court needs to address the issue that Thompson reserved for another day.
That's right. And what do you think is the issue that Thompson v. Craney reserved for another day?
I think the issue that Thompson reserved is whether, if the legislature just decided that it was done with the superintendent and started systematically pulling back all of his duties and responsibilities, at some point, is there a limit on the legislature's ability to do that?
Right, and that they took away responsibility and gave it to no one else.
Right.
Then that's the issue in that wasn't touched in Thompson.
That's the way I see it, yes.
When they give that responsibility to someone else, then you're within Thompson v. Craney,
right.
Because then you have to compare
right.
in your view and in Thompson v. Craney's view, mm-hmm. you have to compare the powers of the superintendent and the new entity or existing entity that has now gotten powers that were with the superintendent.
Yes.
I understand that.
I wonder what source you and Justice Abrahamson have for that. What I'm looking at is the plain language of the case. This case does not require us to decide the extent to which SPI's powers may be reduced by the legislature, and we reserve judgment on that issue. Now, unless I misunderstood your many responses to me on the question, you take the firm position that the act reduces the power. It adds to the power of the governor at the expense of the superintendent. Yes?
Yes, and it does so by putting the governor
then how,
in a superior position to the superintendent.
How do you get all of that? how do you get that sophisticated, detailed reading of the question reserved for a different day when the only thing that was said was we leave to decide the extent to which the SPI's powers may be reduced by the legislature?
Well, because the issue that was before the court in Thompson was what the superintendent's powers were vis-a-vis other state officers. In that case, it was the Secretary of Education that was...
I think said a little more directly, could the powers of the superintendent be transferred to the secretary?
Yes. That's what that particular act is.
A wholesale transfer of power.
And I think it's important to note that Thompson versus Craney did not pick and choose. Those changes were enacted in a budget bill that had hundreds of statutory changes. The court did not pick and choose and say, well, this one can be transferred, this one can't, and engage in that kind of as the Court of Appeals called it, a stick counting analysis.
So
it said that the general principle here is that the superintendent cannot be made subordinate to another officer in exercising the duties of public instruction.
I thought the holding was, and your previous answers to my questions agreed with it, that Thompson said you could not transfer wholesale power from the SPI to the secretary. And now from that, you say this instance is directly analogous to the wholesale transfer of the powers of the superintendent. So therefore, we need look no further than to Thompson to decide this case. Is that your position?
Well, our position throughout has been that this court need look no further than Thompson. We believe Thompson is on all fours and resolves the issue presented.
I understand.
Thank you very much. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ryan Nelson-Stewart, and I represent the defendant respondent, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Dr. Anthony Devers, who, as has been noted, also appears here personally today. Dr. Devers, sir. This case focuses on the ability of the state superintendent to supervise public instruction. rulemaking plays a central role in that supervision for several reasons. First, rulemaking has been part of the state superintendent's rulemaking authority since statehood. The very first law related to the state superintendent gave the state superintendent rulemaking authority to develop rules to hear appeals made to him. Second, the legislature recognizes that rulemaking is necessary for the supervision of public instruction. We've talked extensively here today about the definition of what a rule is and how broad it is, but there's also other sources that show how necessary and central rulemaking is to supervision. There's more than 70 statutes that explicitly require the superintendent to engage in rulemaking in order to enforce and administer them. Further, under WIS Statute 27.10, the superintendent is required to promulgate a rule in order to enforce and administer the statutes. So in order to enforce or administer the teacher licensing statutes or the laws related to special education or school finance, the state superintendent must promulgate a rule in order to do so. The reason why Act 21 runs afoul of Thompson v. Craney is because the state superintendent previously had the ability to approve a scope statement and approve when a role went to the legislature. In Thompson v. Craney, the legislation there transferred power from the state superintendent to the Secretary of Education. That's exactly what Act 21 does with rulemaking. It moves the state superintendent's ability to approve a scope statement, to submit a rule to the legislature, to the governor, an other officer. And the state superintendent is thus made subordinate. The state superintendent has no way to overcome the governor's decision not to approve a rule. They are not equals, as the state has argued in its initial brief.
Counselor, could the legislature have simply enacted 227.19? And there are a couple of references in there to the governor, but essentially it requires that rulemaking be submitted to the legislature, and then sometimes it's referred to committee and so on and so forth. Could the legislature simply have done that and not enacted 227.135? Would there be a problem from the secretary's perspective?
The legislature could have done a number of things in order to make this permissible. The state superintendent, we are not challenging the ability of the legislature to review rules. Under Coyne v. Walker, decision, the legislature will still review it. The state superintendent will still be required to submit it to the legislature for review. The problem with Act 21, however, is it puts an other officer in charge of the rulemaking process, which is the governor. And I'd like to point out, too, that the problem with Act 21 is not just the Thompson v. Craney problem, but it's also that the framers never intended the governor to be an other officer of supervision of public instruction. There's several reasons for this. First, in the constitutional debates in 1848, it was directly presented to the convention a proposal to put the governor in charge of the state superintendent, to have the governor approve or appoint the state superintendent. The convention rejected that. The very first law that was passed in 1848 related to the state superintendent, the governor was given no power or authority over public instruction. That was solely to the state superintendent. And you can also look at the structure of the Constitution itself. We've been focusing on the first sentence of Article 10, Section 1, but also the last sentence of Article 10, Section 1 says the term of office, time and manner of electing and appointing all other officers of supervision of public instruction shall be fixed by law.
Counselor, I never think of myself as an agency. And, of course, if I go and look in 227 as a definition of agency, it does omit judicial officers. And I frankly hadn't thought about the secretary as an agency either. If that definition, 227, were interpreted to not apply to the secretary, how would that affect 227.135, which speaks to the acts of an agency, which I assumed when I was reading it was DPI. I didn't think it was the governor until I went back and I read the definitions and how broad it was stated. But if I interpreted agency as not including the secretary.
Do you mean superintendent? Or?
I mean the superintendent. Sorry, I'm giving him a different title. Okay. I call him SPI all the time, so I should just use my own initials. Okay, if I look at 227.135, it uses the word agency, agency. And when I was first reading it and getting ready for this case, I thought it was Department of Public Instruction, because to me that's an agency. I've not thought about the superintendent being, quote, an agency, because I'm not an agency. Then I went back and I read the definition of the statute. I agree the definition is very broad. If the definition were interpreted by this court to exclude the superintendent of public instruction, what would be your thoughts on the constitutionality of the statutes that you're challenging?
Sure. I think that's a very good point. It's hard to separate the Department of Public Instruction from the state superintendent. I think that's the issue here. And the statutes even flip back and forth between whether it's the state superintendent carries out a certain statutory power or it's the Department of Public Instruction. I think the circuit court said it best, where the state superintendent supervises public instruction by overseeing and running the Department of Public Instruction, which is an agency. It's under the definition under 227.01. It's clearly an agency. And so it's hard to separate those two, because that is the primary means that the state superintendent uses to supervise public instruction, is running the Department of Public Instruction. And the Department of Public Instruction, like all administrative agencies, functions and operates in, by promulgating and following administrative rules.
So what you're saying to me, it doesn't make any difference.
Correct.
I'll have to think about that a little bit, but thank you.
Counsel, your argument, as I understand it, is not a separation of powers argument. Your argument is not a core function argument. Your argument rests on the other officers and how it's interpreted in Thompson.
Correct.
That's it.
Correct. And I think actually the state tries to divert this attention in making a separation of powers argument, but this isn't about the legislative character of rulemaking. Supervision is vested in the state superintendent. And Article 10 and Thompson don't differentiate between whether a certain statutory supervisory power is executive in nature, is quasi-judicial in nature, or legislative in nature. And again, looking back at that very first law enacted in 1848, the superintendent had all of those powers under that very first law. He was required to hear appeals made to him, a quasi-judicial power. He's required to promulgate laws in addition to his executive powers. And so it simply doesn't fit in this nice separation of powers framework. In addition, this raises significant issues following the state's lead about the constitutionality of Act 21 overall, because then it requires this court to look at whether it's a permissible delegation of legislative power.
Why isn't it a separation of powers issue? I think it's just a matter of lens, what angle you're looking at the issue. You can advance the argument that it is the legislature, as I think your opposing counsel does, it is the legislature that confers the power here.
Correct.
And so that it is a separation of powers issue.
But the exercise of that power happens solely in the executive branch. And so this is simply the governor is the one who exercises his power, not the legislature. The legislature has no control whatsoever in the governor in this situation. The state attempts to make it sound like as if the governor is an agent of the legislature, that he provides a procedural check. But Act 21 doesn't contain any procedural checks. It doesn't contain any standards. It leaves it up simply to the governor's discretion on whether or not he approves a law. And it's helpful for this court to look at his prior decisions on the delegation of legislative power, where this court has explicitly and repeatedly required proper standards or procedures on any delegation of legislative power, including to entities that review rules. So in Martinez versus the Department of Industry, Labor, and Human Relations, this court looked very carefully at JCRAR, a legislative entity, to see whether the legislature had properly delegated authority to JCRAR. And one of the reasons why the court found that permissible was that the legislature had established seven different statutory standards for which JCRAR to act. JCRAR couldn't act unilaterally. It had to act within certain time frames. By contrast, Act 21 does nothing in terms of the governor. He doesn't have to act within a certain time frame. The only standard is Act 21 says it's up to his discretion, which is no standard whatsoever.
Well, if you're talking about separation of powers and delegation, the delegation here, as I understand it, is from the legislature to the governor. There's no delegation here from the legislature to the superintendent of public instruction.
Correct.
That's your basic argument, isn't it?
Correct. The legislature is not involved.
Well, only because this is between the governor and, from your perspective, the governor and the superintendent of public instruction, because the legislature has acted to divide powers between them.
Correct.
And I looked in your brief to see where you differed from the COIN brief, and I couldn't find the difference. As I read your brief, again, if I'm wrong, you should correct me. When I read your brief, I look at page 21 in your final statement. Regardless if one views rulemaking as part of the superintendent's supervisory power or a tool necessary to carry out these powers, Act 21 impermissibly makes the governor, another officer, superior to the superintendent in rulemaking. As such, it's unconstitutional as applied to the superintendent, and although you don't cite it there, the reference is to Craney. I'm assuming that. Is that right?
Correct.
Do you differ from the Craney brief?
No. State superintendent, I think it's a very simple framework on how to address the question before the court. The question is simply whether the state superintendent could be subordinate to the governor in the process to make administrative rules that supervise public instruction. It's the superintendent's position that Thompson v. Craney directly addressed the question about whether you can transfer a power previously given to the state superintendent and whether that can be transferred over to the governor and other officer. And as I previously stated, this raises numerous issues, not only in terms of Thompson v. Craney, but the plain language of Article 10, Section 1.
When you read Thompson, I'm looking at page 18. Thompson Court created that held the legislature, put in quotes, may not give equal or superior authority to any other officer. That's the whole problem here.
Exactly.
That another officer, that other officer happens to be the governor.
Correct.
And then the next paragraph expands on that.
So if we just X'd out the word governor in these statutes, you'd be happy, right?
If the governor wasn't correct, if the governor, most of the provisions of Act 21 are not at stake here.
Right.
Act 21 made numerous changes. We are simply challenging the very specific portions of Act 21, which puts the governor, in certain cases, the Secretary of the Department of Administration, in a superior position. But if correct, if you X those out, it would be completely permissible. And as I said,
what about if DPI submitted a rule to the legislature, as 227.19 requires, and the legislature looked at committees, and part of their process was to get input from the governor on whether the governor thought it was an appropriate policy for the state. You didn't have any problem with that.
No, the governor, like any other executive officer, just like the state superintendent, he's free to lobby the legislature. He can provide his input on that. But the legislature, again, the problem with Act 21 is another officer. The problem isn't with the legislature's review of administrative rules.
What about if the Act was interpreted such that instead of the governor having a veto, he had a power of consultation with the superintendent? Would that cause a problem?
I think that would be much more permissible. Because, again, the governor wouldn't unilaterally be able to overrule the state superintendent.
So in that power of consultation, if the governor said, gosh, I just don't think this is a good rule at all, and that was his message to the legislature, then it was submitted to the legislature under 227.19, that would be okay, and it would be up to the legislature to decide what they're going to do.
That's the same. You know, the governor could have done that before Act 21, though, correct? I mean, the governor could have reviewed a rule.
I'm not an authority on what the governor
could
do.
I think it's also helpful for the court just to be aware of, you know, Act 20, or before Act 21, the state superintendent had to follow very strict procedural requirements. This isn't about the state superintendent being able to promulgate rules willy-nilly. The state superintendent still must follow the very strict procedural requirements of Chapter 227, because, again, this court required such procedural requirements in a delegation of legislative authority, and one of those is review by JCRAR, and the governor was free at any time to voice his displeasure about a specific rule. But again, he's not exercising unilateral authority over the state superintendent.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not sure what power of consultation is, but to the extent that you know what it is, I've just not dealt with that concept a lot in statutes. You seem to say that it would be okay to have a power of consultation, yet I thought your whole argument said was, let's stand on the footings of Thompson, which says you cannot give to another officer shared or equal powers. Whatever this power of consultation is, would it be okay? I'm not sure what it is, but how does that interact with a prohibition against sharing powers with another officer?
Sure, I think it would be important to clarify exactly what consultation is. If it's simply the state superintendent has to present a proposed rule to the governor and the governor had to issue an opinion with it so many days or something to that effect, it would be fine. The problem, again, though, is with Act 21, is that the governor unilaterally acts. There's no consultation. There's no way for the state superintendent to override the governor. There's no way even for the legislature to override the governor's decision. And, you know, this leads to another point where it puts the state superintendent in a very difficult position. And it shows why Act 21 runs afoul of Thompson, is that the state superintendent is required by law to promulgate rules all the time. And so when the governor refuses to approve a rule, the state superintendent has a choice. He can either yield to the governor's will and make the changes the governor wants, if the governor even wants any, or he can defy the will of the legislature and not promulgate that rule. So I think, you know, while I think it's important to clarify what consultation is, the facts before this court, it's very clear what the relationship is between the state superintendent and the governor.
Can I ask you a hypothetical question? Let's go back to 1848. The state superintendent of public instruction is a constitutional officer. The legislature doesn't get around to passing legislation for 10 years. So he's the superintendent of public instruction, but there's no guidance from the legislature. Is there any sort of inherent power fashion rules? Because I think Assistant Attorney General here is saying all of this is legislative power, and the legislature can take it back, and it has to delegate it in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting hypothetical because, you know, one of the three Polk County factors is the very first law related to the constitutional provision, and, you know, the assumption under using that as an interpretation is that, especially with the 1848 debate, many of the legislators were in the constitutional debates. So, you know, the intent of the debate is carried through that legislature, and in your hypothetical, that would make it more difficult to know exactly what the superintendent's supervisory power is, because you'd be deprived of that third Polk County, or the second Polk County factor. Instead, we'd have to rely simply on the plain language of Article 10, Section 1, and on the constitutional debates. But, you know, fortunately for this court is we do have that 1848 law, which clearly prescribed rulemaking authority to the state superintendent, among other types of powers that were prescribed to the state superintendent. And, you know, it should be noted that in Thompson v. Craney, you know, they carefully looked at the plain language, but they also looked very in-depth in the constitutional debates and these first laws that were enacted, and they found those second two to be most informative and most illustrative in terms of what the state superintendent's supervisory power entails.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Jolka. Boardman and Clark, and here today as representing Amica.
You'll have to speak up.
Oh, I'm
Could
sorry.
You move the mic up or something? Our sound system is really bad for us.
I'm sorry. Let me.
No, it's not your fault.
No, let me lean into this a little bit. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm here representing the Amici in this case that supports the holding of the Court of Appeals, the Wisconsin Association of School Boards, and the School Administrators Alliance. And I'm going to take a very traditional amicus approach to this argument. You've heard very compelling arguments with regard to the case. And what I'm going to do is take a traditional amicus approach and talk to you simply about some policy considerations that I think are particularly relevant to your consideration. First off, what is the Wisconsin Association of School Boards? Because that's relevant to where I'm coming from. And it's a nonprofit organization that represents all but one of the 424 school districts in the state of Wisconsin. What's the School Administrators Alliance? It's an organization that represents five different organizations of administrators in public schools. So you've got the School District Administrators Association, the School Principals Association, the School Business Officers Association, the Human Resource Association, and you've got the curriculum people. So I'm here really to say to you that this, what I don't want you to do is lose sight of this case, that it's solely about education. It's solely about the question of state superintendent of public instruction and the effect that that may have in terms of your ruling on educational, the educational future of this state. My clients have one mission, and that's to provide the best education to the pupils of the state of Wisconsin that's possible. And from our perspective and the perspective of our clients, the way to do that is to make sure that Article 10, Section 1, which vests in the state superintendent the authority, the supervision of public instruction, that is given the clear meaning and certainly the meaning that was given to it in Craney. It shouldn't be lost on the court, I guess, from my perspective, that essentially the whole educational establishment is represented here in support of the Court of Appeals and the unconstitutionality of Act 21. Not only are the clients that I represent, but also we have a letter attached to our brief of support from, for example, the Wisconsin Rural Schools Association, the Retired Teachers Association, the PTA, and Council for WEAC, the teachers' organization, has been instrumental as well as in being co-counsel for the plaintiffs in this matter. So I think it's important for you to think about the fact that the educational, institutional, and establishment here is represented all in one very important perspective. And why is that? And I think it's because this is the legislation, Act 21, attempts to fix something with regard to education now that's not broken. It's not broken. It as it applies to education, that's all we're here about. Education is working well. The organizations I represent work very well with Mr. Evers and his agency. They collaborate. They work on rulemaking together. That's the way that education is advanced in this state. Secondly, the importance of education was obviously was obvious to the framers. I don't think anybody's mentioned, but I and I don't know how relevant it is, but we all know that the United States Constitution doesn't mention education. So as Wisconsin was going through the opportunity and actually the exercise of creating its own constitution, it realized, and the debates and the consideration foster that, that it realized that it had to deal with education in a very instrumental way. And at the time, things were fragmented in Wisconsin with regard to education. And I would commend to your reading pages 11 and 12 of the defendant respondent's DPI brief with regard to what was going on at the time with regard to the fragmentation of education, the fact that it needed to be uniform. I see my light is on. I'm going to conclude by simply saying I think there's a value of consistency whenever you have a nonpartisan, a public official like the state superintendent, as opposed to a partisan officer such as the governor who may be reviewing rules.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, you may proceed. I've been trying to keep time, as you folks know. I believe that, and my marshal has been trying to help me out too, so I believe Attorney Crawford used up the extra 20 minutes, and then according to my watch, which isn't a stopwatch, there was an additional 9 minutes given to the respondent's time. So I'd like that added on to the rebuttal time in this case, so you'll have more than your 5 minutes. I'm trying very hard to keep it even, and it's not a problem of counsel. You all are very, very good, but we are trying hard to be fair to both sides in the time manner. So please proceed.
Your Honor, if I could just ask what your thinking is as to what time I actually have, so I may know that.
14 minutes, Tina, 14 minutes. And she'll give you the yellow light when you've got five to go, so you'll be able to judge for yourself.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address some of the responses that have been made by counsel for the respondents. First, our position is, and this is based on the clear language of Article 10, Section 1, that there are no inherent powers vested in superintendent. The superintendent has a supervisory power, but what is composed within that or included within that supervisory power is, as the language of Article 10 states clearly, to be prescribed by law by the legislature. The state defendants believed that this issue had been put to rest by the concessions that we've outlined, the concessions made by the respondents, that the legislature has the power to give certain duties and powers to the superintendent and to take them away, including the power at issue here, the power to promulgate administrative rules. We thought that had clearly been settled through admissions, through our briefs and admissions by the respondents. It was surprising then to hear Ms. Crawford's response to the hypothetical posed by Justice Prosser with respect to potentially moving the ability to license teachers or certify teachers away from the superintendent of public instruction and give that power to another officer. That is clearly what happened historically since 1848. As Mr. Essenberg's brief lays out, the legislature in 1848, after the passage of the Constitution, the ratification, gave town superintendents, not the superintendent of public instruction, the exclusive power to license school teachers. And in between 1862 and 1868, county and town supervisors shared that licensing certification power. It wasn't until 1939 that the legislature chose, as it was authorized to do under Article 10, Section 1, to give that power to the superintendent. So again, I think this points out that there are no inherent powers. That is not to say that the legislature, and this goes to the question posed by Justice Abramson as to the reservation at the end of majority's opinion in Thompson, saying that the court was not passing on the extent to which, the ultimate extent to which, the legislature could remove powers. It doesn't conflict with that, because that analysis would be based on, you know, for example, what happened in Act 27, which was the subject in Thompson. The question would be, if all powers were taken away from the superintendent, then you would have to look at whether or not that conflicted with the grant of supervisory power to the superintendent in Article 10, Section 1.
Counselor, do you think there's any way of interpreting the statute such that the governor has a consultative power with the superintendent rather than a veto power over rules that the superintendent or DPI may want to have enacted?
The statute provides that the governor has to approve, for example, at the outset, the scope statement. So I don't believe that could be reasonably construed as a consultative role. The legislature could, of course, decided on that procedure. It decided in its judgment not to delegate part of the administrative rulemaking to the governor in two instances that are at issue here.
Okay, thank you.
Respond to the argument that this is an unlawful delegation of legislative power to the executive branch?
Well, first of all, Justice Bradley, I would point out that that issue was not raised in this case until the SIR reply that we received in this case, and maybe in the briefs by respondents. It was not raised in any response to the petition, so we don't believe that that issue is timely at all. We believe with the protections that are in place, and primarily the one which I stressed to Justice Gableman, that ultimately there is a check on the governor's power here available to the superintendent to go to the legislature, and if the legislature agrees that the proposed scope statement or proposed final rule is something that the legislature believes that the superintendent and the department should have, that can be accomplished by statute. Again, the respondents don't contest the ability, and as they can't under the Martinez case, that the legislature still here has the ultimate authority, you know, whether or not to adopt or let go into effect the administrative rules proposed by the agencies.
Thank you.
Counsel said there was not a lot to do outside of rulemaking when I asked her that question. What do you think of that?
Well, we disagree.
What else is there?
Well, there's the total administration of the Department of Education on a day-to-day basis. The department administers statutes. It administers existing administrative rules. And to say that Act 21, which applies to potentially future administrative rules, totally destroys the ability of the superintendent to supervise public education or supervise the Department of Public Instruction, we just don't believe there's any validity to that argument. What you've heard from respondents as far as...
Counsel, I'm a little concerned with the effect of Act 21, according to you, that the governor could prevent the director of state courts from promulgating rules.
Your Honor, I would go to the agency analysis that Chief Justice Rogan said, whether there's an application there. I believe there are rules there, but the state courts would have the same. And again, this does not go to inherent authority, constitutional authority of the court system, but to the extent that the director of state courts was attempting to propose a standard administrative rule, and Act 21 would apply, the courts would still have the same option of going to the legislature. to the extent, again, that it is an appropriate administrative rules process, and an administrative rules process may not be applicable to something that the state director of state courts was attempting to implement.
Well, it says agency doesn't mean a judicial officer. I don't know if the director's a judicial officer, or that only means judges. Or does it mean the entire court system?
Your Honor, frankly, as far as whether a judicial officer also applies to the director of state courts, we have not taken a position on that. We are not advancing any position in the state which we would believe conflicts with the constitutional power of the state courts.
You don't want to get involved with us.
Counsel, I thought I heard the phrase executive order earlier in these proceedings, and that caught my ear. Is there a mechanism the superintendent can use called an executive order or something similar to it?
I'm not aware of that process, Your Honor.
So probably anything relating to policy directives of the superintendent that would not involve rulemaking would go to advancing the administrative parts of the position of both supervising employees, making sure that the internal policies of the department are being carried out. Anything having to do with the interpretation and advancement of the legislative directors would have to be done through the rulemaking authority. Is that fair to say?
Under the requirements of Chapter 227.
Okay. Thanks.
To just quickly address the respondent's approach to, and indeed the Thompson Court's approach to, the legislative history and the first acts passed after 1848 and 1902. And we believe where the court went wrong in Thompson in fashioning the broad rationale that the superintendent had to be superior to all other officers was based on a wrong presumption. And the presumption was that since the legislature did not give superior authority to another officer immediately after 1848 or 1902, that meant that the legislature could never do that or believed that it could never do that. And we don't believe that presumption is supported at all. It is not a rule of construction that a partial act has implications as to what a future act may entail. The fact that certain powers were given to the superintendent in 1848 and indeed in the first law passed after the 1902 amendment also raises the equal inference that, for example, the power to do certain things related to rulemaking, it wasn't the rulemaking of today, but related to rulemaking, that somehow represented an inherent authority of the superintendent. The equal inference is that the legislature had to give that power, and having given that power, it had the power to take it away also.
Counsel, just for clarification, I didn't think inherent authority was being advanced by opposing counsel in this case as a theory. I heard it discussed in response to a question from the bench, and I think I tried pinning them down, saying that's not their argument, is it? But am I missing something? Do you think it really is their argument?
I did not believe it was, Your Honor, but I was concerned by the answer to Justice Prosser's hypothetical that somehow if that power was taken away, that the superintendent somehow maintained some role in teacher licensing, for example, if the legislature had decided that it did not, that he or she did not. But the state defendants agree with the arguments in the brief submitted by amicus and the arguments made today by Mr. Essenberg. This court has the opportunity to correct the stifling effect if you accept the respondent's version of Thompson, the stifling effect on the evolution of public policy relating to public education in the state. That was foreseen by Justice Wilcox. There has been a gap of almost 20 years. I think it's significant, and this court can infer that gap in terms of the legislature not venturing into the area of the powers of the superintendent was the result of that unnecessary and unfounded broad language in Thompson. The court has to harmonize all things that have occurred in this case, including the concessions that have been made, the various constitutional authority assigned to the legislature, the executive branch, and it must harmonize all of those elements. Under the respondents, Your Honor, I see my light has gone off.
Yes, just if you can conclude quickly, please.
Yes. As we've mentioned, there are two ways to achieve that harmony, that harmonization of those conflicting strands. One would be for this court to decide that Thompson did not control this case, and the second would be to overrule the broad rationale and permit Act 21 to go forward vis-a-vis the superintendent.
Thank you very much, and thank all counsel for just absolutely outstanding arguments and for fielding a lot of questions that I think some of you were surprised with because they weren't in anybody's brief, but it does help us a lot when you try to answer the questions that are bothering us, whether or not you saw them as the focus of your argument as you made the brief. So thank you all very much. We are now adjourned, and the court will meet in closed conference at 2 o'clock.
1:30.
Okay with you? Okay. Okay, 1:30. Thank you. Thanks for helping me out on that, team. I appreciate it. David, we're not going to meet until 2 o'clock. You're going to talk to the kids out here, and there will not be time. Yeah, we're not going to meet until 2 o'clock.
Well, I'll just wait. Let's get this done.